Hey, let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to do this week. This morning, I'm going to try and finish up the discussion about time as a soil forming factor. We almost got finished with it last Thursday, but not quite. And then I will, we're going to move on to the next topic, which has to do with weathering. And we'll probably spend a couple class periods on that. It's probably going to spill over into next week. For lab this week, I'm not exactly sure what we're going to do yet, but it looks like probably going to be indoors at this point, unfortunately. But I'll see what the weather looks like, because we're getting very close to the point where we can go outside. And there's at least a couple field trips that we can make. So we'll just have to see how the weather goes. How many of you have been struggling with the homework assignment? Okay, I know a few of you had questions about it, so I thought I might take a minute and maybe go through a little bit of question number three that might help you get started on this. Now, if you read number three, it says, assessments of soil carbon stocks commonly use soil carbon expressed as grams or kilograms of carbon per square meter based on a soil depth of 1 meter. So calculate this for each soil. And it kind of gives you the framework of how to do this. It says this is done by first converting percent carbon, which is on a weight basis, to a volume basis. And you have to use the bulk density to do that, and also the horizon thickness. And then you do this for each horizon down to a depth of 1 meter and sum them all up. And let me just run through this. I'll do the A1 horizon of soil one, okay? Well, you'll see that the depth or the thickness of that A horizon is what? 3 inches. We don't want to use inches, so if you convert that to centimeters, it probably works as well as anything. That would be 7.6 centimeters, right? Everybody with me so far? And probably the biggest challenge in any of this is keeping the units straight. Okay, so then if you look at the organic carbon content of that A1 horizon, what is it?
It's
4%, which, if you think about how to write that, I think the simplest way to do it is call it 0.4 grams of carbon per gram of soil. Is that fine with everybody? 4%? Okay. And then we also need to have the bulk density in there, which is what, 1.12? And notice the units on that. 1.12 grams per cubic centimeter. And let's just look at what we've got here. So 7.6 centimeters times 0.04 grams of carbon per gram of soil times 1.12 grams per cubic centimeter. Well, what happens to the units here? I guess this 1.12, we could call it grams of soil per cubic centimeter. Yeah?
Sorry, was the 1.12, is that a constant?
No, it's a bulk density.
Oh.
Okay, and that's, if you remember from intro soils, bulk density is how you move back and forth between a mass or weight of soil and a volume of soil. Okay? So, and this will be different for all the horizons. So if we look at the units here, what's going to happen? Well, here's grams of carbon. We've got grams of soil here and grams of soil there, so those are going to cancel out, right? And we've got cubic centimeters here and centimeters over there, so that's going to make that centimeter squared, right? And if we multiply that out, we're going to come up with, we get 0.03405, and so our units, if we look at what's left over, we've got grams of carbon per centimeter squared. Is everybody with me so far? Nothing too magical, but we need to do a little bit of manipulation with this now, because our units here are grams of carbon per square centimeter, and I think if you look at the directions here, you want to get it per square meter. So what we need to do is take this 0.04 grams of carbon per square centimeter and convert that into a square meter, right? And the conversion would be this. If you look at that, 1 cubic centimeter is the same as 0.0001 square meter, right? So if we multiply this out, square centimeters are going to go away, and we're going to end up with this little bit of rounding off. But so we've got 3,405 grams of carbon per square meter, okay? So that's the contribution of carbon from that A horizon of soil number one. Then you just do the same thing with the second horizon, the third horizon, fourth horizon, on down to where you hit that 1 meter depth, which is going to be the bottom horizon. And you sum all these up, and that's going to give you the total carbon present there. And you can either express it in grams of carbon per cubic centimeter, or this would be the same as per square meter, sorry, 3.405 kilograms of carbon per square meter. No difference there. Either way is fine. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so it's just repeating this a few times and doing a little bit of summing up and then answering the rest of the questions. So if you have any difficulties with it, let me know. You can stop by or send me an email. Okay. Probably the most common thing people mess up, though, is they get the units screwed up. And that's always a potential source of error, you know, but it's... Remember the Mars probe that they got yards and meters screwed up, and the thing didn't land on Mars, it crashed instead. Anyway, so you got to be careful of that. It can make a big difference. Okay, on Thursday, we started talking about time as a soil forming factor and kind of raised this question for you. How long does it take a soil to form? This seems to be a question that gets asked all the time. And I think we decided the good answer is it depends, right? And I said that for a lot of scientific questions, it depends is always a good answer. And I guess I want to go revisit that just for a moment. You know, why does it depend? Well, a couple reasons. One is that if we're looking at the how long it takes to form a soil, we have different kinds of horizons in there. And for example, think about a forest litter layer, an OI horizon. How long does it take to form one of those? It wouldn't be that long, no. I mean, we're talking about something that might be on a decadal type of scale, you know, 10 years, maybe a little bit more. But really, it's something that it has a biological time frame associated with it, because we're talking about the litter that comes out of trees and collects on the forest floor, right? And obviously, it's going to get decomposed. It might take an OA horizon a little bit longer to form, or an OE horizon, but generally, just the OI horizon, not that much. What about just a plain old A horizon? How long does it take one of those things to form? See? Yeah, you might be looking at something that's more on a century scale, you know, maybe hundreds of years, somewhere in there. And there's been a little bit of work done on this, a lot of it in relation to restoration following mining and things like that in the, well, eastern United States and western United States. And the bottom line is, if you take a initial material, we'll call it the parent material, and get something seeded in it, it does not take very long before you start to see the melanization process, the darkening of it. But, you know, to form a good A horizon, let's just say it's on the order of hundreds of years, and it might even extend up to, you know, thousands of years to completely form an A horizon. How about something like, how about an E horizon? How long does it take to form one of those? Well, all of these are going to be dependent on environmental conditions, but you can find examples of E horizons that are probably going to form in, you know, again, I think we could say maybe hundreds of years. Might be very similar to an A horizon. How about a BW horizon? All we need for BW horizon is what? A little bit higher chroma, or perhaps a little bit of soil structure. So once again, I don't think we're looking at a really long time period. Maybe it's put hundreds to maybe a few thousand years, somewhere in there. What about something like a BT horizon? Well, it's going to take a little bit more when we start thinking about clays, and we might ramp this up to maybe 1,000 years to 10,000 years, something like that, somewhere 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth, somewhere in that range. We've talked quite a bit about this, a BKQM horizon, one of these durapans, the carbonate silica cemented horizons. How long does it take to form one of those? Well, that's at least tens of thousands, so we probably have to say 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 5th, maybe even a little bit more as far as the range there. How about a BO horizon, one of these senile soils that's just dominated by iron and aluminum oxides, residual accumulation? Well, again, we're probably looking at something on the order of maybe 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, you know, so hundreds of thousands or maybe even a million years, somewhere in there. So I think you get the idea. There's quite a range here. And the other thing that you might consider is, well, how about this? How long does it take to form a sea horizon? What's the good standard answer? It depends. Well, what does it depend on in this case? Yeah, the paramaterial. I would argue that if you're starting off with something like granite, it's going to take quite a while to form a sea horizon, because initially it's going to be R material, right? As it weathers, it might go into C with the little r, the soft weathered bedrock, and then eventually sea horizon. But how about contrasting that with the luss that we have around here? How long does it take to form a sea horizon in luss? Well, I don't even know it takes 1,000 years. It really doesn't take, it's pretty much deposited as a sea horizon. So it's unconsolidated, and you know, it's sort of a ready-made sea horizon as it's deposited. So there's a big range, and it really depends on the starting material. And that's why whenever you see an estimate for how long it takes to form a soil or the rate of soil formation, take it with a grain of salt. And you'll commonly see this number about 40 years per centimeter of soil. NRCS likes to use that a lot. And I think in most cases they're probably talking about maybe an A horizon and a prairie soil or something like that. But take it with a grain of salt, because it's extremely variable. Yeah, Bryce?
You know how long they say the soil crust,
The biological crust, yeah, that you see in the desert areas? I think with those, because they're biological, you're probably getting back into this, you know, 10 to hundreds of years, somewhere in there. And I'm sure you've got some advanced stages of it. But again, that would be more of the biological time frame. Whereas when you get up into these BO horizons and BKQMs, that's more of a you know, really intense chemical type of process, so you get an accordingly much longer time frame. Well, let me, I want to run through some the pictures that I've got that are just illustrative of time as a soil forming factor. And you remember back when we first got on to the soil forming factors, and we're talking about this concept of a chronosequence, and how I think I was using the terraces in the Boise area as an example, where the low terraces are young, the higher terraces, at least down there, are extremely old. And that's an example of a chronosequence. But I want to show you another one that is on a much different time scale. And this is, the setting here is Juneau, Alaska. Have any of you ever visited the Mendenhall Glacier, just just outside of Juneau? Okay, well, this is up on the, looking at the terminus of the glacier, kind of looking southeast. Juneau would be down here. And so you're really looking at the end of the glacier and then the area that used to be covered by the glacier but isn't anymore. And one of the things about the Mendenhall and most of the other glaciers that are up in the Juneau ice field is that they are receding. And they've been receding during historical time. So if you look at something like the Mendenhall, where here's the glacier, the map on the left, and Mendenhall Lake, but originally it came down considerably further and has been in retreat. And so this little diagram that you see on the right, here's the glacier to the north, here's the lake, and then you can see this series of moraines that are exposed after the ice retreats. And a lot of these, you can see the time frame on here. This one right here, they know it's 38 years old. These are historical records. 70 years old, 90 years old. People were around then to see it, so they know exactly when that moraine was exposed. This one, 240 years, it's getting a little more difficult to age these things, but this 240 years would be based on tree ring data. So it's not quite as precise, but because you might have a little bit of variation there depending on the trees. But this is another example of a chronosequence, but you can see that the time scale here is much, much less than what we were talking about on the those Boise terraces, because the youngest one down there was 14,500 years. Well, this is the guy, Earl Alexander, who did this study, and that's the Mendenhall in the background. It's really kind of a cool bit of work. So this is what the soil looks like on the 38-year-old moraine. It's got alder and cottonwood growing on it. And you can see the profile there. It'd be kind of difficult to pick out a bunch of horizons, wouldn't it? The nails that are stuck in here are indicating horizons. You can see there's a very thin A horizon up there at the top, and I think that's probably all you really see is just the beginnings of A horizon development. And then you get into the older moraines where you actually start to get stands of spruce and hemlock, and this would be probably something approximating the climax vegetation up there as it starts to move in. And here's the soil profile from the 240-year-old moraine. See any horizons in that thing? Well, it looks like there's probably a good O horizon up on top, and then what's underneath that O? Yeah, it's a little difficult to tell, but there's definitely an E horizon in there, and then below the E horizon, this dark reddish-brown horizon we'd probably designate as a BHS type of horizon. So what we're getting is the expression of podzolization, and we're seeing it in about a 240-year time frame. And this is also from this next image here. It's just a table from the study where they're classifying the soils, but they're sort of putting the list of horizons in here that you start to see on these different age moraines. So the A horizon, 38 years or so to start to see that. And you get down to the good BH horizon, and this would be older than 240 years old. And I guess the other thing in this chronosequence is you kind of get this feel for how the soil and the plant communities co-evolve. And that's what they're trying to illustrate down here with the successional stages of vegetation. You start off, you get fireweed and alder and things like that on the really young moraines. The trees start to come in, and finally in about 350 years you can get a mature stand of the hemlock and spruce. And you start to see the change in soils as well. So this is just an example of a chronosequence that's on a much different scale than the one that you saw before. I put this one in here too. This is from a soil exposure in New Zealand. It's really interesting because the whole thing is composed of different aged volcanic ash parent materials. And you can see the ages are indicated over here on the left. The uppermost layer was an 1886, an eruption. Second layer, 1300, 1314 AD, and then 233 AD, and then we get into 5,500 years before present and 9,500 years before present. And if you keep going down, you get into older and older ash deposits. But what's interesting is you can see the horizon sequences that have formed in each one of those different units. And so up top, 1886, so roughly, you know, a little over 100 years old, 120 years old, something like that. You don't really have a good B horizon yet, but kind of start, you might call that a BW, I don't know. You go back here, notice how all those horizons are buried, and then come down to this older unit, these are all buried, and these are all buried. So a very complicated type of a soil profile because of these different ages, but it gives you an idea of how this process whereby you get a soil forming, you get younger or new parent material added on top of it, as you would expect in a place that gets periodic volcanic eruptions. The soil formation starts over, that gets buried, soil formation gets reset, starts again, that gets buried, and someday this upper unit's probably going to be consist of buried soil horizons because there'll be something on top of that. Yeah?
Would we see something similar to that on the Pacific Rim volcanoes?
You can, and if you get over closer to the source in the Cascades, you can see some fairly distinct layers of volcanic ash and pumice that are of different ages. And you will see a different amount of soil development, you know, depending on the age. So it's another way that you can actually come up with absolute ages of soil horizons. And that's because all of these tephra units that are very well documented in terms of when the eruptions were. You can see they're fairly well constrained, 5,530 years plus or minus 60 years. And those are done with radiocarbon dating, but still they get very well constrained ages on them. So, you know, another way to get at this question of how long does it take a soil to form. Well, this is the last image, and this is out of your book. It's table 3.12. And this is based on some really historical studies, early studies that were done to estimate rates of soil formation. And they've got a whole bunch of different, either soil horizon or a profile here. And what they're doing is usually the age upon completion is probably based on radiocarbon dating. And they go ahead and they calculate a rate of formation. And this is years per centimeter of whatever that soil material is, based on the thickness of it and the age of it and the references over here. And again, all this really shows is the range where up top there you've got an entisol on a volcanic ash that formed in volcanic ash, so very young soil. It's only 45 years old, and they calculate a rate of formation of takes 1.3 years per centimeter of that soil. And you kind of go down here, here's A horizons and different soils. Here's an organic soil, here's a podzolized soil or spodosol. All the way down to the bottom, you're getting into an oxisol. And here you can see that the calculated rate of soil formation is 750 years per centimeter of material. So quite a range there, depending on environmental conditions and a lot of other things. So I guess that's kind of it for time. I just would, maybe the take-home message is to think about it in terms of the biological context, where we think about O horizons and A horizons as relatively young, whereas the horizons that represent a great deal of chemical weathering that we start thinking about thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years in the time frame for those things to be formed. So really a big, big range. Any questions about this? Okay, well, we're gonna kind of shift things up a little bit and start talking about weathering. And I wanna, I guess as a way of introducing it, maybe go over what could be a little bit of view material and maybe some definitions here. One of the things that we want to do is think about this whole concept of weathering as that, remember the generalized processes? We had the one called transformations. And we said that could be chemical or physical changes that take place in the soil. And we've talked about the biological end of things with the role of organisms and different types of soil horizons and soil organic material and that. But what I'd like to do is maybe think a little bit more about the rocks and minerals and really the types of weathering reactions that go on in the soil, not the necessarily the biological ones, but more of the chemical weathering types of reactions. And I guess you guys might remember this sort of thing from intro soils, but I think it's, hopefully you do, but it's always good to bring it up again, because what we're going to do for the rest of this class period and next time and probably even next Tuesday is talk about these different types of weathering reactions, and we're going to be talking about the same groups of elements. And does anybody remember, if you look at the Earth's crust, what the most abundant element on a weight basis is going to be? In the Earth's crust, we go out and get a rock, granite, basalt, something like that. What's the most abundant element?
Silica.
You're close. Silica would be number two on the list. Number one.
Carbonate.
Hmm?
Carbonate.
Carbonate's not an element, but within carbonate, you've got the
oxygen.
Oxygen, yeah, would be number one on the list. And I wouldn't worry too much about these percentages, but depending on where you look, the oxygen is going to be something on the order of about 47% on a weight basis, almost half. Silica, generally somewhere around 28%. The point being, if you look at those two things together, silicon and oxygen, that accounts for about 75% of the Earth's crust on a weight basis. And I would extrapolate that a little bit further, and it's the Earth's crust or the average for the Earth's crust, and it's going to be very similar in most soils too. You'll see a little variation depending on the rock type, whether it's basalt or granite, but these would be pretty close. What would be number three on this list?
Aluminum,
yeah, and I think somewhere around 8%. So it's starting to drop off. If we look at the next one on here, it would be iron. And that's somewhere around 5% as an average. I'll just fill this out. We got calcium, 3.6%, sodium, 2.8%, and potassium, 2.6%. And then the last one I'm going to put on this list is magnesium, and that would be about 2.1%. And if you total all these up, you should end up with more than 99%. So anything else that we would put on this list is not really going to be that abundant in terms of the percentages. Those would be the top eight. So I guess the point here is that what are the elements that we're going to be talking about mostly for the next couple class periods if we want to consider weathering and the associated processes? Well, aluminum, silicon, iron, calcium, and so on. So these, think of these elements as the building blocks that make up the Earth's crust, and maybe more specifically, the rocks and minerals that we associate with the Earth's crust. Now, I guess that kind of brings us to another point. That is, so these are elements, right? And then if we think about how these elements might organize themselves together, for example, if we take silicon and aluminum, we might have that formula, SiO2. And what do we call that?
Quartz.
Yeah, silica or quartz, but even more broadly, what would quartz be? We're not to the rocks yet. Just quartz is a, geologically we would call it a mineral, right? So, let me write this up here. Mineral, And if we wanted a quick and easy definition of a mineral, we could say that it's a naturally occurring substance that has a definite chemical composition, like SiO2, and it has a characteristic ordered crystal arrangement. So we normally think of a mineral as usually two or more elements. That are combined according to this definite defined chemical composition like SiO2, and also this idea of a crystalline type of a structure to it. So if we take, and I said usually two or more elements, there are minerals that technically are made up of one element, but they're rare. Generally, you might have several elements, and a lot of them are going to be the elements on this list, right? Oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, so on. So what do we get if we start combining these minerals together?
Rocks.
Yeah, then we get rocks. So we think about rocks as being an aggregate of usually two or more minerals. And we're going to talk a little bit about characteristics of rocks here and their mineralogical composition. But so just think of this hierarchy. So you get the elements, and then these elements arrange themselves into minerals, and then the minerals are the components of rocks. And so that's kind of this idea of the Earth's crust. A couple of notes. We are going to be talking about mineralogy or soil mineralogy. I think if you look at the list of minerals, there's about 4,000 of these things that have been described. The good news is, if you think about soils, there's really about 10 or 12 that are pretty much all you need to think about. So we don't need to be concerned with most of these 4,000 different minerals. And the rocks, we're going to keep this really simple in terms of how we talk about rocks and their composition. But think back to last week's lab where we had, I don't know if you looked at the examples of the basalt and granite and some of the intermediate, the igneous rocks and their composition. And I guess that's what I'd like to spend a little bit of time on. But just maybe one last thing before we leave this. If you think about rocks, what would be some examples of rocks that come to mind that you know of? Okay, basalt's one, granite's one. Come up with another one.
Limestone.
What's that?
Limestone.
Limestone would be one. Any of those things that were sitting out on the lab bench last week would be examples of rocks. Okay, how about other minerals besides, we mentioned quartz already, what would be some others that you know of or have heard of before? Kaolinite, very common one in soils. How about smectite? Dolomite is technically a mineral that you run into some problems like dolomite. People use that. It's the mineral name, but it's also used to refer to the rock that contains it. What about things like feldspars, the most abundant group of minerals on Earth? And what do you think they're composed of? Aluminum, silicon, oxygen primarily, with some other things thrown in there that are often off that list as well. So there are a lot of different types of elements, but that are a lot of different types of minerals that we might consider. And so what I want to do is maybe talk a little bit more specifically about some of these, the different types of minerals that we find in component rocks. Okay, let me get this tied up. Okay. So if, let me see, I don't know if you guys have downloaded this next presentation. It's the one called Weathering. And you might want to, if you haven't taken a look at it yet, you should. Because that's what I'm going to be talking about the next couple class periods. But start off, this is a cartoon. It's not really a hilarious one, but so you got the dad and the son. They're at Inspiration Point, probably the national park. And the dad says, "Someday, my boy, all of this will be clay." And this is one of the really basic concepts of weathering and soils. And that's concept number 9 that's in your book. I think these are on page 13. But it, if you read this, it says, "Soils are natural sites for clay mineral formation on land surfaces. Most primary minerals on Earth crystallize from magma at high temperature and pressure. When exposed to lower temperature and pressures, meteoric water and organic compounds near the land surface, in other words, a soil environment, these minerals decompose by processes known as weathering. Some of the elements reassemble into new minerals structures of clay size. It's likely that the clay particles in the shale and other sedimentary rocks are products of mineral alteration in soil prior to erosion and deposition." So I guess to summarize this, it's that all of the clays that we find on this earth probably formed in a soil environment at one time or another. And I like this first part of the statement. Soils are natural sites for clay mineral formations, or maybe another way of putting that is that soils are actually clay factories. I mean, that's what happens. You take all of these minerals that are found in the Earth's crust, and these things eventually are going to weather and turn into clays. These very small particles that are dominated by what elements? Oxygen, aluminum, silicon, with a little bit of this other stuff thrown in. Okay, and this is the handout that I gave you. The reason I printed it out for you is because on your notes it's probably impossible to read. But this is kind of a complicated table, and I'll see if I can explain what you're looking at. But up top is a list, you see the heading up there, silicate minerals. It's got the mineral name and it's got the composition. Then the next column here is the density of the mineral, probably not that important for us. And then the heading up there that says igneous rocks, these would be the major types of igneous rocks that we find. And they have them split into what's called plutonic and extrusive. And that's those rows going across the top. Plutonic simply means that it's an intrusive rock. In other words, it cooled somewhere beneath the Earth's surface, so it cooled slowly, meaning that the mineral grains are large. And then the extrusive rocks are the ones that the magma was actually extruded out at the Earth's surface, so it cools very rapidly. The minerals that are in it tend to be small. And you can see the examples. The plutonic rocks, granite, diorite, gabbro, peridotite, dunite, the extruses, rhyolite, andesite, basalt. Well, there's some ranges of composition that we associate with those rock types. And I put this red box around the granite and the rhyolites. And we talked a little bit about this, I think it was last week, how granite and rhyolite mineralogically are the same rock. The only difference is in the grain size. The granite's the intrusive, the rhyolite is the finer grained extrusive rock. But notice the composition. About 27% is going to be made up of quartz. And you notice there's the composition of quartz, SiO2. About 40% is going to be what we call potassium feldspars or orthoclays. And you notice chemical formula, potassium, sodium, aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. Not very surprising looking at that list over there. Here's some other types of feldspars. These are called the plagioclases. You can see that one's a sodium aluminosilicate, the other's a calcium aluminosilicate. These would be a fairly 15% or so of would be in granite, rhyolite. We get down here, biotite, and these are complex aluminosilicates of potassium, magnesium, and iron, all off that list. 12%, and then amphiboles, in parentheses they say hornblende, that's a real common example of an amphibole mineral. Also complex aluminosilicates of calcium, magnesium, and iron, and that might be about 6%. So that kind of gives you an idea of the mineral composition of granite and rhyolite, dominated by quartz and feldspar, right? Well, if you had to describe the color of granite in the most general terms, you've all seen it up on Moscow Mountain or other places, how would you describe it?
It's like coarse grained.
Okay, it's coarse grained. What about color?
Dark, black.
I don't know that it would be dark, because quartz and feldspars generally are whitish colored minerals. So granite in general tends to be a very light colored rock. You may see some little dark flecks in it, but that's probably the biotite and or the amphibole that's present there. But predominantly white or light colored. And on the far side of this figure, you can see the arrow up here, felsic and mafic. These are very general terms that I think I might have introduced in lab last week that refer to the either rocks or minerals based on their composition. Felsic rocks or felsic minerals are the ones like quartz and feldspars that are generally light colored, and they tend to be dominated by silicon and aluminum and oxygen. Whereas the mafic minerals or the mafic rock types are generally darker colored, and these are the ones that have a lot of iron and magnesium in them. Sometimes people call them ferromagnesian minerals. And they would be things like biotite, hornblende, the pyroxenes, and so on.
What was the, for felsic, they're dominated by oxygen and?
They're primarily aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. They don't have much iron in them, they don't have magnesium, large quantities. But it would just really, primarily it's going to refer to the feldspars and quartz. So we would characterize granite and rhyolite as being a felsic rock, right? Because they're dominated by quartz and feldspars. Okay, now let's contrast that with basalt, or the coarse grained equivalent would be gabbro, which is not quite as common, but basalt, we've got a lot of it around here, right? But look at the mineral composition. How much quartz is there in basalt? None. Very different. How much potassium feldspar, orthoclase? None. What starts to show up here, there's a lot of calcium feldspar that's present in basalt, and then a lot of these mafic minerals, primarily pyroxenes. These are the iron and magnesium containing minerals. What does basalt look like in general in terms of color?
Dark.
It's dark, yeah. You see it along the highway between here and Pullman. And so it would represent a mafic rock type, or one that's generally dark in color and tends to be dominated by these minerals that have a lot of iron and magnesium present in them. So very different mineralogical composition between granite and basalt. And then you can see diorite and andesite would be intermediate. Does this make a little bit of sense? I don't expect you to memorize this, but I just want you to get the idea that the parent materials or the rocks can have very different mineralogical composition. And this has a big impact on what happens to them in terms of weathering. Well, this is a figure that is not in your book, but just out of a soil chemistry book. And what it shows is just the average composition of different parent materials in terms of elements. And they express these all as oxide forms, but there's silicon, potassium, titanium, aluminum. You should recognize most of those. And all I put this on here for is to show you the range. If you're looking at a granite type of composition versus basalt versus shale, which is sedimentary rock, here's sandstone, another sedimentary rock, and another one over here, limestone. Not surprising, limestone's going to be dominated by what? Calcium and you look at something like granite, it's going to be dominated by silicon. And that kind of goes back to what we've been talking about. So you do have this difference in composition depending on the type of material. But here's the point when we get into weathering. Remember that all of these magmas, they are under heat and pressure, right? And as these things start to cool is when the different minerals that are going to be present start to crystallize and come out of this magma and form a solid. Well, some of the minerals crystallize at high temperatures, some crystallize at lower temperatures. And this really, I guess the way I would think of it, if a mineral precipitates out of this magma at a very high temperature and pressure, what that means is it's going to be very unstable in a soil environment, right? Because it formed under very hot and high pressure conditions. So you stick it on the surface of the earth in a soil where you've got low pressure and low temperatures, and it's not going to be stable, and it's immediately going to start to weather. And so you get this whole idea of a weathering sequence. And then this figure 4.1 is out of your book. And all it refers to is the relative stability of minerals that you might find in parent materials in a soil environment. And you can see that they have two branches here, mafic minerals, felsic minerals. And the ones at the top would be the least stable in a soil environment. And you come down here, and at the bottom, you've got quartz, and that would be the most stable in a soil environment. So in terms of weathering, what would you expect to start to weather immediately in a soil? Something like olivine or this feldspar anorthite, whereas something like quartz is going to tend to be quite stable and persist for a long time. So this weathering sequence, you can also consider it to be a stability sequence as well. And the whole point is that these minerals, depending on their composition, they have different tendencies for how rapidly they want to weather. So generally, mafic minerals tend to weather very quickly, and some of these more felsic minerals like quartz, muscovite, potassium feldspar, they tend to be a little more stable and weather more slowly. Well, that's a good point to stop, all right? So we'll pick this up on Thursday, and as I said, probably not going to get finished, but it'll spill over into next week as well.